Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, to hear Dr. Anne Cunningham make her first appearance at the Sydney Institute. Our speaker, Dr. Cunningham, was born and raised on the border of Northern Ireland. She completed her PhD at Macquarie University, and she holds an honorary fellowship from the Australian Catholic University. Anne Cunningham's first book, The Roman Connection, Ireland, Australia and the Empire, 1865 to 1888, was also her PhD, and it examines the relationship between the Catholic Church in New South Wales and the Roman Curia. Now, Dr. Cunningham's here tonight on the occasion of the publication of The Price of a Wife, The Priest and the Divorce Trial, and we have called her talk tonight, The Price of a Wife, Test Cricketer Arthur Cunningham vs. Catholic Priest Denis O'Haren. Anne Cunningham, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Before I begin my intended talk, I was wondering if any members of the audience here are familiar with the O'Haren divorce scandal. Oh, good. Good. That's terrific. Well, I intend refreshing your memory, Anne, and yours. But for the rest of you, I think you'll find this story a bit of a fascinating story. And so now let's get on with the bones of it. In December 1900, Arthur Cunningham, Australian cricketer, petitioned the courts in Sydney for a divorce from his wife, Alice. Now, I'm presuming there are cricket lovers among the here tonight, and I've included a photograph of the 1893 cricket team of which Arthur was a member, and you can see him here at the front. This team actually beat England in the Ashes that year, and it was captained by Jack Blackham. But that's a story all in its own right, so let's get back to my main story. Now, Arthur was born to English parents in Brisbane and was reared as an Anglican. But he had no problem with the religious affiliation of his future wife, Alice, who was a practicing Catholic. Leaving the religious upbringing of his children to Alice, he appeared uninterested, or didn't care really, that they were baptised Catholic. Alice, during 1898, admitted to Arthur that she had been unfaithful to him while he was away playing cricket. Surprise, surprise. She confessed that her lover had been none other than Dean Denis Francis O'Haren, Vicar General at St Mary's Cathedral here in Sydney, and private secretary to Australia's first Cardinal, Patrick Francis Moran. Now, O'Haren had been born in Ireland. He spent his final years of high school at Clongowes Wood in Kildare, which would be Ireland's forerunner to Australians, or Sydney's Ignatius College here in Riverview. Educated by the Jesuits in his final years, he went straight to the Irish College in Rome to train for the priesthood. Now, I focused on O'Haren's early days to outline his comfortable middle-class upbringing and to assert that in Catholic Church terms, he was earmarked for advancement in the Church. During the early 1890s, O'Haren was deputy president of the Irish College in Rome. It was at this period he came to the attention of Cardinal Moran when visiting Rome. The two men quickly bonded, and O'Haren agreed to become Moran's private secretary in Sydney. Now, as Moran, the cardinal, aged, he relied heavily on O'Haren and refused to see any fault in the priest's character. From 1892 to 1899, as Moran's private secretary, O'Haren had seniority over many of the priests in the diocese. It was during these years that he met Alice Cunningham, a volunteer helper in the cathedral here over the road. Now, Arthur, as an accomplished cricketer, was regularly away from home. He argued that an affair commenced between O'Haron and Alice from 1898 and finished in 1899 when Alice became pregnant with their third child. Alice confessed all to her husband, but O'Haron strenuously denied any such affair had occurred. Now, the concept of no-fault divorce did not exist in 1900. I think we can thank Gough Whitlam for its introduction. A woman in 1900 was the property of her husband, and if he believed she had been unfaithful, he could sue his wife's lover for damages to his marital bed. Arthur Cunningham in the courts accused Father Dennis O'Haron of sleeping with his wife Alice and demanded £5,000, close to nearly $500,000 today in damages. I guess he thought a lot of his property. The priest denied the charges against him. Two court cases ensued before the charge of adultery against O'Haron was declared unproven. Now, the focus of the 1873 Divorce Act was to protect property rights. However, the Act also sought to prevent vexatious claims being brought against prominent individuals, let's face it, they were largely men, from colluding couples intent on extorting money. Clause 28 of the Act stipulated that should the Crown Prosecutor prove that a husband and wife deliberately set out to trap an innocent individual, then the costs and damages could go the other way. It was under this clause that the priest O'Haron defended himself. Now, Arthur Cunningham and Dennis O'Haron were poles apart in lifestyle and personality, yet both played their respective role in entertaining and scandalising Sydney's newspaper readers of the early 20th century. Alice, the errant wife, became the pawn of both. Others were drawn into the vortex of the trials, most notably Cardinal Moran. Relishing the discomfort of the most senior Catholic cleric being grilled in the dock, evangelical Protestants looked on the case as a golden opportunity to strike a blow against their old foe, the Catholic Church. Under the leadership of the Reverend William Marcus Dill Mackay, a true believing Orange man from Derry in Northern Ireland, now we have three Irish players in the scene at this stage, shelter and financial support were given to the Cunninghams throughout both trials. Now, sectarianism or religious bigotry constantly bubbled up and below the surface of Australian society well into the 1960s. This case had the potential to erupt in violence. Passions did run high. However, members of both denominations became engrossed as details of the alleged affair emerged and the antics of individuals involved descended to the level of farce. At fashionable dinner parties, O'Haron's innocence or guilt was the topic of conversation. Sydney's burlesque music halls got into the act and devised songs in honour of the three main players. Now, you can hear from my accent, I arrived in Australia in 1981 and my husband Eamon and I, and when we went to dinner parties, it was Did She or Didn't She? It was the Azaria Chamberlain trial. Now, I'm trying to say if you can think of that trial in the context of what the O'Haron case was in Sydney in 1900, and the situation was very similar. It is not hard to understand how this divorce case preoccupied the imagination of Sydney at the turn of the 20th century. Given evangelical Protestantism's antipathy to Catholicism and celibacy especially, the potential unearthing of a senior clerical adulterer was too good an opportunity to miss. The church threw the resources into the task. The stakes were higher for the Catholic Church. Cardinal Moran was outraged that he, as a stranger's most senior prelate and first cardinal, would be forced to stand in the dock like a common criminal. Equally abhorrent was the prospect of witnessing his confidant's reputation destroyed by a woman he viewed as nothing more than vile. Sympathy for O'Haron and his plight took side stage to everything Moran had lived and worked for, the consolidation of the Catholic Church in Australia. From his perspective, the Church stood to be judged and condemned by godless Protestants. The institution, he believed, had to be protected at all costs. Money, he assured O'Haron, would be no obstacle. It was and would be used in the defence of the priest and the institution. Now, on a human level, Arthur Cunningham too stood to lose substantially should he not be able to prove O'Haron an adulterer. Financially, he would be ruined. But as Arthur was regularly in debt, financial problems were the least of his worries. Under the Act, if proved that the case was an attempt to extort money from the priest and the church, he and Alice faced the possibility of jail. In fighting the case, Arthur believed he could easily prove O'Hara's guilt. He seriously underestimated his foe and the capacity of an institution under siege to strike back. Now, for those, and most of you, I'm glad to hear, are unfamiliar with the case, there were two civil cases brought by Arthur against his wife and O'Hara. To complicate matters, Arthur conducted his own prosecution against the couple without any help from a barrister. No barrister of the period, Catholic or Protestant, would touch Arthur, fearing that if they had, were seen to be involved in the destruction of a career priest or a senior Catholic priest, their future businesses would be boycotted by the entire Catholic community. And the Catholic community was very substantial at the time, about 30, 40% of the population. So the first trial ended in a hung jury with an 8-4 result in O'Hara's favour. The four who held out for a guilty verdict did so on sectarian grounds, as there was no concrete proof of either Alice or O'Hara's guilt. Justice Simpson, in his statements, frequently showed an anti-Catholic bias. Now, to date, I have outlined the backdrop to the case. There have been accounts written on it, most notably Dan Green's 00, which has dominated the input of future historians. The question needed in addressing here tonight is why look at it again? Well, missing from the account has been the primary sources gathering dust in St Mary's Cathedral. These detailed records have been the missing pieces of the overall scandal. First and foremost are the letters of a whistleblowing priest by the name of Father John Kenny, and I think we're hearing a lot about whistleblowers at the moment. Mm-hmm. Interesting times. The backdrop to Kenny's letters are as follows. John Kenny was an All Hallows-trained priest in Dublin. From a socio-economic perspective, he was very different to the urbane, Rome-trained Dennis O'Hara. He had a venomous dislike of O'Hara, and that outlook quickly became apparent after reading one or two of his letters. He saw the divorce scandal as a perfect opportunity to bring his nemesis down. He wrote approximately 10 detailed letters to Arthur Cunningham, who passed them on to our friend Reverend William Mackey, who used them in his continuous crusade against the Catholic Church. I think Marcus Mackey would... Ian Paisley is the closest in modern terms I could come to old Mackey. He's a very funny man, beyond all. Basically, the letters accused O'Hara of repeated sexual misconduct and of being an inveterate card player. Frankly, Kenny's accusations... have an uncomfortable, not that that's important, but anyway, his accusations have an uncomfortably modern feel to them, but thankfully minors are not involved. Arthur, in his own case, and in conducting his own case, mesmerised all in court, particularly with his capacity to understand the finer points of Catholic theology, particularly when it came to the definition of mental reservation. Essentially, this church teaching permits an individual to be evasive or withhold the truth from an interrogator or third party in extreme circumstances. I think it usually means under pain of death, not any other circumstances. Anyway, in the first trial, a debate erupted in the courtroom, openly encouraged by Justice Simpson, I might add, on whether or not Catholics could be trusted to tell the truth under oath. This encouraged the belief, amongst all and sundry, that Catholics, when giving testimony, would lie and then seek forgiveness in the confessional, thus leaving them conscience-free and with the belief that they'd never lied in the first place. The debate took a more sinister turn when it was implied that priests could and would use their moral authority in the confessional to intimidate Catholic witnesses into giving favourable evidence for O'Hara. But what puzzled O'Hara's defence lawyers was the strength of the grasp Arthur had of this and other Catholic teaching. It became obvious that he was being advised by a Catholic priest. Further to this was their dismay at Arthur's detailed knowledge of O'Hara's private life and movements. Now, I don't have time here, constriction of time, to detail the Kenny letters in depth or how O'Hara's lawyers got their hands on them. Essentially, they set up a sting to entrap the whistleblowing priest through the post office system. Now, the head of the post office in Sydney at that time was a man by William Patrick Craik, a dubious Catholic, and who in his capacity as Postmaster General and a member of the Legislative Assembly at the time, organised the illegal interception of Arthur Cunningham's and John Kenny's post. Think of the old kettle steaming trick, right? Typewritten copies of the priest's letters were made by Dan Green, that's the author of our book here, 00, replaced in their envelopes before being posted on to Arthur Cunningham. Arthur's letters to Kenny were handled in the same manner. Now, I think I might have a slide of Crick there, Kazan. Yes, that's William Patrick Crick there. Arthur had no idea his letters were being read by the Catholic camp, nor did the poor Father Kenny. Thinking he was incognito, and to cover his tracks, Kenny signed himself as Zero, hence the title in the book previously that Dan Green called 00. Crick and Green can take the credit for unearthing the hapless Kenny. Now, moving along, Cardinal Patrick Moran's private diaries are equally enlightening. On reading them, I had the distinct impression that they were written after both trials and when O'Hearn was declared innocent, with the intent of protecting his own reputation in the eyes of future Catholic generations. I say this because although they are dated by Moran from the commencement of the second trial, Moran's sentiments appear to be one of relief at the acquittal of O'Hearn. They also reveal his deep affection for the priest. From my experience and previous knowledge in my previous book of the Cardinal's career, he was extremely careful about showing open support for an individual if there was any hint of their guilt. The diaries clearly show that Moran was aware and supported the activities of Crick and Green. The Cardinal truly believed that the Church was under attack from Beelzebub, it was wonderful the terminology when I was reading his diaries, who had reappeared on earth in the guise of the Orange Order and Evangelical Protestantism. His attitude to women, too, was apparent. He tended to view them simplistically as either Madonna or whore. Alice most definitely was in the second category. Repeatedly he refers to her as that vile woman who, like the Orange Order, only wished for the destruction of the Catholic Church. He placed his trust on paper in the Virgin Mary to bring the Church through. Then we come to the papers of Susanna Dill Stevenson in the State Library. She was the daughter of our friend William Marcus, or Mackie. Her insights into her father's behaviour do help us understand the evangelical crusade he was on. He truly believed that the influence of the Catholic Church was evil, and he made it his mission in life to try and destroy it any opportunity when he could. Now, when I analysed the sources in St Mary's, particularly the financial records of what was spent by the Church in order to defend O'Hearn, the behaviour of Crick and Green is explainable, though highly illegal. They were given by Church authorities complete freedom to do whatever it took in order to clear O'Hearn's name and uphold the reputation of the Church. In essence, £7,000 was spent defending O'Hearn. In my overview of the accounts, there was a further £1,200 which I could not account for. This reputably was used for the purchase of a property in Fairfield near Parramatta. Now, to give you an understanding of what this figure means, in 1900 the pound sterling was worth approximately $88.81. So if you times 88 by 81 by 7,000, that comes up at about $630,000. If the other £1,200 proves to be real, we are speaking of another £106,000 or thereabouts. Who's counting? The amount was enormous for the period. So how was the money allocated? Well, of course, the legal eagles involved were the best and paid accordingly. I do not intend to focus on them. Rather, I would prefer to look at the minions and how they fared out. Before I come to our friend Dan Green, who wrote this, I've taken a random sample of defence witnesses for O'Hearn. Thanks, Catherine. Right, good girl. In 1900, a defence witness would be paid on average £1 for their expenses. This would be towards loss of income, food, travel, etc. Now let us look at these three witnesses. James Exton had been a personal friend of Arthur Cunningham. Exton claimed that he became a defence witness because of his competence, influence of his wife, and his fear of Dan Green, who's written the book beforehand. Reality check, he had none of these. His motivation was greed, pure and simple. Repeatedly he was questioned as a witness as to whether he was being paid for his evidence. He denied any monetary gain. Now technically he was not lying, as I can trace that payments only started to him on a staggered basis at the end of both trials. And you can see he was paid £245 by 88, by 81. Such a nice amount of money. His role for the defence was to spy on Arthur and Alice. He further helped Crick and Green intercept their correspondence in order to prove that they were colluding. Arthur never suspected him of duplicity. William Miller was the manager of a property in Fairfield called Berylda. It was a market garden and bed and breakfast. Both Arthur and Alice stayed there for some time, and Alice was ensconced there before the second trial. Their financial records reveal that £54 was paid to Miller. His role was to allow a number of private detectives stay at Berylda in order to facilitate the drugging of Alice. This had to be done so that her correspondence could be stolen. This was required for the purpose of getting a handwriting sample, so that it could be compared with letters already in the hands of Crick and Green, reinforcing O'Hara's defence team's assertion that Alice and Arthur were working together in order to blackmail O'Hara. The third person who lived in Berylda was Trenary Marquette. For one day's evidence, she was paid £12.6 and 8. She was the housekeeper. She had been employed there under the instruction of Green again and Crick. She started working in the bed and breakfast just as Alice arrived before the commencement of the second trial. Her role was to spy on Alice's every movement and report them back to Green. Now, all three of these witnesses for the defence had been set up by Dan Green in order to either spy on Arthur and Alice or steal their correspondence. When they gave evidence during the second trial, all played their roles magnificently. And the rest, shall we say, is history. Arthur in that second trial never stood a chance. Finally, I would like to look at Dan Green. As I outlined before, his account of events has been seen by many as the account, and I could see historians were calling on it right up until, 100 years later when I got my hands on the story. He would have you believe that he acted for O'Hara out of a sense of altruism and fair play. He did genuinely despise religious bigotry, but tolerance of difference was not his real motivation. He ran with the highest bidder, as can be seen by the amount he was paid, £639. His history is deeply flawed when it is juxtaposed against the new primary sources. In essence, to achieve O'Hara's acquittal, Green was prepared to lie, cheat and steal in order to attain the outcome he wanted. Now, some here may believe, before I analyse the newspaper reporting of the trials, that I've glossed over the sectarian nature of the case. The trials were deeply divisive, but it is too simplistic to assume that denominational hatreds were the motivating factors of those involved. Old-fashioned greed, personal animosities, Kenny's letters, the classic scenario of a woman spurned by her alleged lover O'Hara played a larger role than sectarian hatred. Time and again I found the religion card, discriminating against me, only surfaced when all other arguments appeared redundant or people's backs were to the wall. This can be seen in how the newspapers handled the scandal. Now, Sydney's society in 1900 was eclectic, but it did share a commonality, a hunger for news and gossip. What's new? The main dailies, the Sydney Morning Herald and the Daily Telegraph, had the lion's share of the market. But smaller publications such as the Newsletter and Truth were also popular. The Bulletin, with its biting satirical tones, tended to appeal to a more sophisticated middle-class audience. The first trial duly commenced on the 3rd of December 1900. During both trials, newspapers such as The Australian, Telegraph and The Herald shied away from direct commentary due to the contempt laws. The first trial ended in a hung jury, 8-4 in O'Hara's favour. It was the worst possible outcome for the priest and the Catholic community, particularly as Justice Simpson openly inferred that Catholics, particularly those of an Irish background, we couldn't win, could not be trusted to tell the truth under oath due to the malignant influence of the confessional. He was referring, of course, to the Catholic teaching of mental reservation. In the letters pages of the main dailies, evangelical Protestants wrote copious letters ridiculing this teaching of the Catholic Church and its role in the confessional. Responding, Sydney's second vicar general, John Carroll, penned a letter enclosing the signatories of the majority of the Sydney's metropolitan priesthood, depicting their sense of dismay and outrage that as a body they would condone or encourage their parishioners to lie under oath as a result of advice given in the confessional. they further protested against the vile and malicious insinuation that Catholics could confess their sins to a priest in the sacred tribunal of penance and to receive absolution may afterwards in a court of justice truly swear they never committed these sins. Their biggest grievance lay in the supposition that non-Christians could swear and believe in a courtroom, yet no such credence is to be given to the sworn testimony of Catholics when the reputation of their priests or the interests of their church are in question. This dastardly insult we regard as a shameful libel on the honour and veracity of our Catholic people. Now, the Evangelical Council stepped up the heat with further attacks on the church. They argued that it was nothing more than a doctrine concocted, by the devious Jesuits. The Jesuits now got into the fight, and the mantle was taken up by Father Edward Masterson from Ignatius College, St. Ignatius College in Riverview. Before the commencement of the second trial, Masterson wrote four letters to Sydney's daily papers in response to the council's assertion that the teaching was nothing more than a ruse to facilitate an end justifying the means approach in order to protect the Catholic Church. Masterson traced the evolution of the teaching, pointing out that it was in place many years before the formation of the Jesuits. Masterson, by engaging Dil Mackie, sought to appeal over his head to the fair-mindedness of ordinary Protestants. This was important, as the council tended to argue in simplistic terms that the teaching was nothing short of perjury. Now, had the sectarian tensions not been so high, the debate entered into by both parties might have been productive, rather than ending in a sullen draw. Overlooking Dil Mackie's motivation in attacking the Catholic Church, it did have some good side effects. Sydney's priests and Masterson kept the animosities to written fisticuffs. This protected ordinary people of both denominations from escalating their differences into a full-on physical brawl. Now, the second trial duly commenced in March 1901, and the Daily Majors resorted to their traditional style of reporting. The smaller broadsheets took a more creative approach. It used their sketch artists to commentate without directly transgressing the contempt laws. Now, O'Haron was a very vain man and self-conscious about the length of his nose. If you think back on the earlier picture I showed you, the sketch artist mercilessly lampooned him when drawing him, exaggerating the length of his nose. If we go on to the next one, I think it's better. Thanks. Thus creating a Pinocchio factor. The bulletin cleverly picked up on community interest, if you go ahead, Catherine, and portrayed a city incapable of going about its normal business. You can see that's a wonderful picture, I think, from the bulletin. That's the whole trial for me in a nutshell, this sketch. You know, where's your photography? That your photographers are. I mean, I enjoy talking pictures, you know, when you watch it. But I think that's a wonderful. The whole trial is there in that sketch, I think. In picking out, people couldn't go about their normal business while they waited for each day's outpourings from the courtroom. This is another sketch, I think a wonderful sketch in 1900. The bulletin was covering the visit of the Governor General. He appeared incapable of making an impression on the people of Sydney due to their engrossment in the trial. So you can see it really gripped people's imagination. Now, the Catholic press reacted in a predictable fashion, seeing evangelical Protestant plots at every corner, and they were setting out to destroy the sanctity of the priesthood and their leadership within the Catholic community. Now, I could not resist including this little excerpt from the Catholic press. When news of O'Haron's freedom, that's one, that's Crick's book, I might go on to the next one, but you can see there's Catholic, there's plots everywhere. But this came out in the Catholic press, which would be probably like the Catholic Weekly today, after the trials when O'Haron was declared innocent. I'll give you a few minutes to read it, a breather.
No, you should read it.
All right, okay.
Yeah.
General enthusiasm, thanks. And joyous exuberance of spirits were manifested here in learning of the verdict of the Cunningham case. Reverend Mother of St. Joseph's Convent calls the convent bells to be rung as a paean of victory, and the enthusiasm extending in all quarters, soon a great crowd assembled. In all directions could be heard handbells, cowbells, and even kerosene tins joining in the din. One irascible old Methodist lady said, "You Catholics seem to have gone mad," and was told they had good reason to rejoice thus. There was only one bell silent in Captain's flat. That was the public school bell. Some person, thinking that the rejoicing should be universal, jumped the public school fence, and soon the large bell joined in the din. Now, the Freeman's Journal, more sympathetic to Irish causes of the period, focused on the sense of unity within the Catholic community and how they were prepared to monetarily show support for O'Hearn and the Church. In its edition of February 1902, the journal published the complete and audited accounts of the contributions made by wealthy and ordinary O'Hearn Catholics to the O'Hearn Defence Fund. The community raised in excess of £8,000 in less than about 3 or 4 months. Most of that was due to the work of women. O'Hearn was very popular with women for some reason or other. Anyway, this statement of support for the church was also a message to the broader community that Catholics were prepared to fight for their rights in a federated Australia. Now, with respect to the mainstream press, once unfettered, their coverage tended to take a pro-establishment and status quo stance. Dominated by male writers, the outlook of the press was one of relief. In congratulating O'Hearn, their arguments focused on the need to protect men from the malicious demands of scheming women. The Sydney Morning Herald and the Daily Telegraph both agreed that the hung jury scenario in the first trial was the worst outcome any man could face, and openly concurred that no other result but victory for O'Hearn was possible in the second trial. The Bulletin, tongue-in-cheek, declared that all men under the age of 98 could now breathe a sigh of relief. In April 1901, following the New South Wales Legislative Assembly election, John Norton, editor of Truth, failed in his re-election bid. Bitterly, he claimed that his re-election campaign had been destroyed by the Catholic Church. In an open letter to the Catholic community, Norton blamed the recent Cunningham case for his failure. Norton argued that a political campaign of protest had been conducted against him by the Catholic priests of the Sydney Archdiocese. Speaking, he asserted, without the benefit of mental reservation, he wrote that he had nothing to do with the manner in which his journalists had written about the case, and he also denied helping Arthur write his final summation. He could not comprehend, nor would he believe, that the Catholic community would willingly see the Scotch sectarian snake raise again its baleful head within the social and political arena. Now, John Norton became the owner of Truth in 1896. Born in England, Norton was Protestant in background, but he genuinely despised sectarianism, and his career in promoting the future Labour Party stands as testimony to that. Prior to the Cunningham divorce trials, he had worked on the party's development. His open letter appealing to the fair-mindedness of Catholics was a portent of things to come. Working Catholics did flock into the fledgling Labour movement, but once its leaders crossed their ideological beliefs or loyalties, many conservative Catholics stayed with what they knew, which was their church and community. Norton argued in his open letter that he was their first victim. There was some truth in this assertion. However, by 1900, Truth had become more sensationalised, and Norton was capable of ruffling the feathers of more than just the Catholic Church with his abrasive style of journalism. I think we know a few of them today. But anyway, Norton argued strenuously that his paper had been the only one which had allowed Alice and Arthur Cunningham a fair voice. Now, the posturing of different papers I could see over the O'Hearn trial reflected the infighting between journalists and politicians as they used their medium to forward their own political agendas. Now, in conclusion, the above newspaper analysis represents the sophisticated argument of the political and educated. What of the reaction of those at the lower end of the socioeconomic structure? The case reverberated for years, and in 1904, Dean O'Hearn received a letter from a frustrated and angry Catholic, Larry Hogan, who was deeply upset by the continuous teasing and bullying he was receiving from his Protestant superiors in the city's Sydney hospital. Hogan claimed that some of the junior doctors were preparing a Christmas concert, and as part of the programme, they would perform a farcical quartet at the expense of O'Hearn. Viewing their sketch, as an attack on the priest and his private Catholic faith, Hogan included the words of their song. In analysing its lyrics, the words were ribald and outrageous. They were funny in a crude manner. They included, "He's a dear kind doctor, Mrs. Cunningham. Oh, I could do it a bit, the cardinal. How could they tell that I'm Irish?" Old Langton: "I believe it, for my mother told me so." Dennis Francis: "Who'll have a drop of wine, Mrs. Bonner?" "Alice, where art thou?" Dean O'Hearn. Now, I can't include any more because the words became worse, more vulgar, as the doctors really developed and got stuck into their theme. Hogan could only see anti-Catholicism at work. Now, it's a fine line between satire and genuine discrimination. Hogan's letter did not reflect the comments of a highly educated individual, and therefore he would not have had the verbal skills to retaliate against the jeering tones of his Protestant superiors. To him, it was discrimination. However, the scandal, because of its public nature, meant that people would see it as a source of salubrious fun. Hogan and Catholics in general had to and did develop a thick skin as a consequence of the Cunningham divorce trials. Thank you all.
Many thanks to Anne Cunningham. Now, we've got some copies of The Price of a Wife, The Priest and the Divorce Trial, which is not long out. It came out a few months ago. And they'll be on sale tonight for $30. And if you've got mental reservation, you can pay later. Is that all right?
No.
Right.
Just pay.
So now we come to questions and discussion. Now, thanks for a fine presentation. It is a great story. And I remember buying it at a second-hand shop. Well, Anne may have bought it many years ago. Anne bought it a picture planted on of O'Hara, just a photograph. So obviously people put his picture up on the wall. But you, as you know, you're addressing the Sydney Institute, and you can't squib it. Now, as you know, there was a famous case in the 1950s of Sydney Sparks or at University of Tasmania, and people had to come to conclusions whether Orr had had an affair with a female student or not. I always thought he did. What do you think about this case? I mean, was the allegation against O'Hara correct or not? You've got to come to some kind of conclusion. Maybe with reservation, but conclusion.
That's putting me on the spot.
Yes,
thanks.
Come back here. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, did I catch them together? No. Was there DNA evidence? No. And in those days, in a divorce situation, you know, you had to be caught together before it could be proven. So that's what I'm saying. If O'Hearn had not been who he was, or if he'd been an Anglican priest, I'll put my neck on the line and say the case would never even have got across the doorstep of a courtroom. It was definitely because of who he was, etc. However, I believe Alice. Very much so. And that's my instinct from reading her stuff and reading the actual original court transcripts. She was very believable. But maybe I'm biased. I'm a woman.
But before we go on, we'll go to all the other questions. And as you know, it appears there was issue of this relationship. So
yes.
The third child. So what happened to there? Because that's only a bit over 100 years ago.
That's right.
The person could have lived up to relatively years.
Right. Well, I have traced the family, and if any of you know, Arthur and Alice had three children. The first one, Arthur Cunningham, became one of Australia's first genuine... No, well, I better backtrack. I'm new to Australia, I always tended to put more emphasis on the Second World War than the first, though that's almost Lethal here with Gallipoli and all the rest of it. But... In the Second World War, Arthur Cunningham's son, who was also called Arthur Cunningham, became a truly genuine Australian war hero. He was Sir Arthur Cunningham, and he was head of the Air Force in the whole of the Pacific region during World War II. They went to New Zealand and all the rest of it. So that was the first. The second child was Mabel, and I've been able to trace that there was no... she never married. Arthur married, but... Mabel didn't. And the third child, who was the question mark child, Alice claimed she called him Vincent Francis in honour of Dean Dennis Francis. So the child, and Arthur never accepted the third child. Now, I've been able to discover that all three, Alice, Mabel, and young Vincent Francis were buried together in the one and together in the one graveyard in Somerset in England. Sir Arthur lost his life flying in a passenger plane over the Bermuda Triangle, would you believe, in the late 40s, early 50s. So I think, you know, when people ask, why would you write a book like this? Yeah, they were very naughty, all of the people involved, but you can't help but like them all of them, actually, all of the individuals.
Peter, you just don't stand in front of the camera. Yeah, Peter, yeah, right, that's okay.
Dr. Cunningham, you said a minute ago that I believe Alice.
Yes.
Well, that has enormous consequences.
I know.
That means the juries were wrong and that the allegations against O'Hara were right.
Yes, but maybe what I'm saying is the lack of evidence at the time, it couldn't have been proved. And I'm saying in today's court, without DNA evidence, it would never have got to court. But having said that, and you have to understand the sectarian passions that were flaring at the time, it became almost, verbally open warfare between the two communities. And but I'm saying from all my reading, I would not put my faith in Dennis O'Haran. He would not be my concept of a hero and a Catholic priest, if that answers your question. Yeah, thank you.
Yes. This theory of mental reservation,
yes.
Do you think that was applicable, is applicable to the Catholic Church in regard to the protection of priests and so on in the recent topic?
Well, I would say it is a distortion of the real teaching. The real teaching was St. Liguori. I'm not going to give you a whole lesson on it. But anyway, and it was to do at times of the Inquisition and afterwards and all the rest of it. In other words, if somebody has a gun to your head and asks you, you are allowed to distort the truth. Does not mean you lie on ordinary matters. So it's only in situations of extreme circumstances. And let's face it, we can all twist. So it's how
it comes out of the Reformation when particularly in England when the priests were going to be hanged, drawn and quartered. Yeah. That's where it comes from.
Yes.
What happened to Father Dean O'Haran? Was he moved to another parish?
Oh yes. he was, he suffered too, in retrospect terms. But he was earmarked. Moran had him, he was all the way to the top from Moran's perspective, but Cardinal Moran died in 1908, I think, or 19, around that time. And William Kelly became the next Archbishop, and suddenly, I came across letters where Kelly was talking about how careful we have to be, and suddenly Dean Francis got moved over to Darlinghurst, where he spent his... There's a wonderful... If you're ever out in Waverley Cemetery, and my kids think I'm cookie, because I love cemeteries, mm-hmm. And out in the Waverley Cemetery, if you go out the Irish every sort of year, the big 98, it's just opposite is old Dean O'Haran. Beautiful tombstone, all in marble. So when I go out there, I'll sit and have a chat with him.
So what year did he die?
He died about 1931 or two. Yeah. But I would feel sorrier for the whistleblowing priests, what happened to them. One of them got kicked out off to America, and the other, there was another priest involved, and he kept getting moved around the poor parishes, New South Wales. So the church can have its own revenge. Yes.
Was there no issue from the third child?
No, I haven't been able to find it.
The question was there issue from the third child?
That's, yes, I did. I haven't been able to find any, and I actually got in touch with the Royal Air Force Historical Site to see if they could help me in England, because they're buried in Somerset and Thrill, and I've heard nothing. So I am still digging on it.
Ellen?
Your fascinating story has points in common, I think, with the Sister Liguori case.
Absolutely.
Have you ever thought of something about that?
Yes, I have.
It's a question about the Sister Liguori case, but you need to background us on that.
All right. Sister Liguori. Another fascinating case, or she is known as the runaway nun. And essentially, actually, it points up, I suppose I've been very conscious of your following, despite my Irish accent, I've actually lived longer in Australia than I've lived in Ireland, but you can't get away from Ireland if you want to put that in space. And I'm following what's going on in Ireland with over the baby scandals and the church scandals. And I just understand, I'm only beginning to understand how repressive it must have been for either Catholic or Protestant in those times. But Liguori was a woman who joined the convent from Ireland, came out to Australia, and after 10 years, you know, she said, I've had enough, and wanted to leave. And in those days, the constraints that were put in front of religious people on leaving their vows and all the rest of it. So the whole thing, too, became a whole sectarian case, like the O'Haron case. And she basically ran away. The church tried to get her back. And even there was a whole case over how the bishop tried to have her committed on the grounds of mental illness. And I looked at that woman's case and I said, if this case had happened in Ireland at the same time, he probably would have been successful, because the church was more powerful in Ireland at the time than it would have been here. In other words, you had the courts were still dominated maybe from an Anglican perspective. But anyway, she ended up her days with the family who took her in a Protestant community, and she lived till about the 50s. But it, you know, for I don't know. Like, I just think I came through the Catholic Church in the 70s, growing up in Ireland, when things were really changing and opening up. But I think for people coming through the 40s and 50s, it must have been a terribly repressive time for people, I think, in the church. So everybody, there were victims, be they clergy or be they individuals.
So, yeah.
Just to add some spice, can you give us a little background on where Alice and Father... whatever his name was, got together. I mean, what were the social, connections?
We were very friendly with the ex-Irish ambassador to Australia by a man named Richard O'Brien.
Oh, yeah.
And Richard is a fond of wicked and good stories. So he told me he got very friendly with a very prominent Australian Catholic historian, Nat Patrick, another very... I won't name the name, who was an ex-priest, and people were a bit annoyed with him at him in St Mary's Cathedral. But anyway, this ex-priest was on his way through the historian and was being bought through by a peer of his through the cathedral, down the back and all the rest of it. And your man was very sanctimonious, and he said, oh, thank goodness for Dennis O'Haron, he's been freed. But that's where they did it. The priest suddenly turned around to this. He said, that's when they did it. This is only because, sorry, when they were in the cathedral.
In the cathedral.
In the background. I didn't know, Dickie. I think it's...
This place is full of gossip.
It's gossip. Good gossip. Yeah.
Down the back and then here. Yeah.
Dr. Ann, could you tell me, following on from Peter Coleman's question and his son-in-law, whether in the light of the, and my own interest as a barrister, whether this case would have got a lot of attention for the amount of money and cost of the trial alone, without breaching contempt laws, as you said, which the Herald was wary of at the time.
Yeah.
Would the case have got a lot of attention alone for the amount of money expended?
Oh, yeah, every day the papers were, they just did the whole transcripts of what happened in court. If you go to the newspapers of the day, the 1900, every day they were full. I mean, that cartoon I showed you from the Bulletin, that wasn't an exaggeration. People were transfixed, be they Catholic or Protestant. And let's face it, it's celebrity in the dock. Think of big trials that we've had here since. You can't walk away from it. And the fact of a Catholic priest being in, everybody loves scandal. I think we wouldn't be human if we didn't love a good scandal. But what I'm saying is, I think, I do believe, in today's term, the case would never have got to court. There was prejudice there, almost definitely, yeah. Yeah.
I'm wondering whether the amount might have been, in fact, been even understated. When you give that comparative of 88
yeah.
pounds, don't always look at that nowadays when comparing values. But I'm just interested.
Yeah.
Suggestions that the 700,000 equivalent might be underestimated.
Well, it could be, but that was still fairly substantial for me when I came across it. Yes.
Oh, I was just wondering about the divorce proceedings, because it was the divorce case. Now, if O'Haron was found to be innocent and not the correspondent, would that mean that Ellis was not...
No, what they did was the result that came out was it was proved unproven, but there was a rider put in on the judgment saying that the pair had not colluded.
Right.
to blackmail him.
Oh, I see.
And that was the only reason they got a full jury on the second trial. And that was again where the prejudice came in, because they realised that Arthur and Alice could go to jail. If you were found to be guilty, like they were found to be guilty, not O'Haren. So that meant technically they could go to jail, but the jury insisted that this rider be put in, that Arthur and Alice could not be accused of blackmailing the priest. So it was good warfare.
So tell us about them. I mean, did they stay married?
They stayed married. They went to New Zealand. And afterwards, I'm really fond of them. I mean, they were a pair of scallywags, absolutely. And Alice got sick of Arthur, and she divorced him in 1912 because she caught him having an affair with a housekeeper or something where they were living. So Arthur, you know, sort of ruefully said, I accused the priest, he got off. She accuses me, I say I'm innocent, but I've been found guilty. And he went to jail too. He was caught in a fraud case, blackmailing stuff. But that's the story. I mean, you see, cricketers in those days weren't paid like today. And there are certain modern cricketers, one in particular that reminds me very much of Arthur, but I daren't say it.
Yeah, except that Arthur only played one test.
But he was still there.
And tell us about him, because he ends up in a lunatic asylum.
He did. And then the poor story, Crick, who was instrumental, Patrick Crick, who was instrumental in his downfall. The Crick family, I was able to find them online, and they tell a wonderful story where their family today all get together, and four generations later they talk about the scandal. And in that, they talk about poor old Arthur ended up in Ryde hospital, mental hospital. And guess who his psychiatric nurse was? A young man by the name of Crick, who's the nephew of Patrick Crick. And the joke in the family was poor old Arthur couldn't get away from the Cricks. Yeah.
No, I think we're pretty well near the end of our
guy.
Yes, Peter.
Yes.
Until your book and... The main recent account of the trial was Philip Ayres in the chapter in Philip Ayres' biography of Arthur Moran.
Yes.
I wondered if you, as a result of your far more detailed research, have any particular criticisms of the way.
Oh, that's a bit harsh.
Ayres. I think. Did you get anything wrong that you have corrected?
I probably have embellished more. In other words, for me, when I was doing all the research, and there's a very good archivist now at St Mary's, and she brought out all the stuff, and I came across this thick folder, and it was all figures and that. And I said, oh, that's boring. It's typical historians. That's boring, and I put it aside. And but unfortunately, I'm married to a man who knows a bit about finance, and his belief in life is follow the money trail. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'd better go back to that. And it was a shock to my system, because the complete... financial records were there for Thomas Slattery's, where the solicitors, that was the solicitor, Thomas Michael Slattery, and the barristers that used, but every penny that was paid. So being an historian is a fascinating game, I think. It's a bit like a detective. So I said, right, okay, well, that's dates, facts, money. So then I went to the New South Wales, and I think in fairness to Patrick O'Farrell, he may have got the original transcripts of the trial. I was able to marry the payments to the days of the trials, and I could see what witnesses were being paid, which is a bit illegal for any legal eagles here. And I said, whoa, this story is so much bigger. So it was from that when I saw... I have a copy of the history that historians to this day will still use. And I got it rebound because, I mean, I'm very fond of it.
This is 00.
This is Dan Green's history. And this was written within 3 months after the second case. Now, it's like a good journalist. This is a ripping yarn, and off he goes. And it's reputed that Cardinal Moran bought 20 copies of it and handed it out to his friends. And it's written in a, you know, a wink, wink, nudge, nudge style. Aren't we brilliant? We got one over them, right? So... it's a bit dodgy, the history, but Philip is on the right track. I think I've just gone deeper. And he was writing with a different purpose in mind, I think.
And when were the papers released by the cathedral? Papers for this case?
I think recently the archives are opening up.
So would
Would Philip Ayres have had access?
Oh, he would have seen them. I can see from his history he has seen them. It's probably just I was prepared to be a bit more expansive, as I say.
Okay, well, I think... Oh,
well,
that's fine.
I just wondered whether you had any evidence at all that the Vatican took an interest in this case. And
They would have. You see, Cardinal Mourne, in fairness to him, and I have a lot of admiration, he was a consummate prince of the Church. He was the first cardinal, and for him this was an attack totally on what he was trying to achieve here in Australia. And I suppose being Irish, you know, they also felt they were getting it with both barrels. So, for him, it was war. This was Beelzebub, as he said, they were fighting. And if he could get one over Mackie, he would. And that's the Irish factor in the whole. I mean, there is huge comedy in this story, I think, in the carry-on that went on. And maybe it is because of my Irish background and, you know, growing up with a mother who came from the Falls Road in Belfast, as I said. Like, I kind of understand the carry-on that these people would get up to me. Do you know what I mean? So, like, you think we'd have moved on. Well, we have. Even Ireland, God, I think, is moving on. But I could immediately see it, you know, the whole atmosphere. But for Mourne, it was war. Oh, it was. You know, the Catholic Church was under attack. And genuinely, he could see no wrong and no harm.
So, no final harm. Question. You've come from this rather... boring-sounding PhD, The Roman Connection, Ireland, Australia and the Empire, 1865 to 1888. And you've gone on to this embellished story, The Prince of a Wife. The Priest and the Divorce Trial. And what's next?
Well, I don't know, but my three daughters keep telling me, you know, for God's sake, Mum, burn it and write the bestseller, you know. And that's when I was doing my PhD. They said, if we have to listen to any more about a Catholic bishop, we think we'd jump out the window, you know. So, and to a certain extent, and then I kept saying to them, this is a story I want written first, but I do genuinely believe this is one of Australia's ripping yarns. And, you know, when I watch somebody like Rake or something like that, you know, I could see this story being done very much so in that light, you know. So hopefully, maybe down the track.
Okay, many thanks.
Thanks, Jerry. Thank you.
Well, it is a ripping yarn, and it always was. And Anne Cunningham has told us the story very well tonight. So I'd just like to say thanks for a great presentation. It's been great fun, but also it's an important story. And no doubt when you write your bestseller, we'll have you back. But in the meantime, I think there is good reason for this to become some kind of film. Because it is a great story. But for tonight, many thanks and well done.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.